Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee to order pursuant to House Rule 10.01. Today we have various commissioners here from DHS to present the governor's supplemental budget overview. That is the only item on the agenda, so we should have plenty of time to discuss that. And all the materials you can find on our Human Services Finance and Policy Committee webpage on the Minnesota House of Representatives. Okay, the first item on our agenda is to take roll attendance. Ms. Hansen?
Yes, good morning. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Lead Albright?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Keel?
Present.
Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Mahler?
Present.
Representative Noir?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Perfect. Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandel?
Present.
And Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, members. Have a great weekend.
Okay, we have a quorum. Thank you, members. So also, I just wanted to note that next week, if we have floor session on Tuesday, we will not be meeting. So our first meeting will be Wednesday at 8:30 next week, but watch your emails because things could change. Okay, members, let's see, we need to approve the minutes. Representative Robbins, would you like to make a motion to move to approve the minutes from March 18th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Robbins moves the minutes from March 18th for approval. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, I see Commissioner Harpstead, I believe, is with us. Welcome back to our committee, Commissioner. I know you have a presentation to share. Please share the presentation. And members, you can also find this in our portfolio of materials. We'll start with Commissioner Harpstead and then we'll turn it over. So I think we could stop at the end of each section, Commissioner, if that's okay with you, to take questions sure. from members. Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to share the proposals from Governor Walz's supplemental budget that affect human services. Today, you'll also be hearing from our assistant commissioners who will be walking through the proposals from their areas that are new or have changed since we last presented to you. The governor's supplemental budget proposals for human services build on the priorities that we laid out in January. This includes targeted investments that support the agency's mission, measures that reinforce our process controls, and efforts to help Minnesota recover from COVID. We don't want to just get back to normal. We want to get back to better. While we are encouraged by recent progress fighting COVID, there's no question the burden of the pandemic and its economic fallout have been significant for low-income Minnesotans. Consider that over the past 12 months, we have seen an enrollment in MFIP, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, of 18%, or nearly 5,000 families. The Minnesota healthcare programs, Medicaid and Minnesota Care, have seen an enrollment up 11%, 75,866 enrollees. Our Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, has seen an enrollment up 11%, 21,646 families and individuals who need assistance with food security. In the face of this great need, we're grateful for the improved economic outlook for the state. This has allowed us to remove some of the more difficult cuts we proposed in January and make some key investments to help ensure an equitable recovery, all while making sure we are crossing our T's and dotting our I's. Our proposals are based in part on listening we've been doing in the communities we serve. I'm especially proud of our proposal to maintain family connection in foster care, which was informed by discussions with the community. I'm also pleased that we're able to do more for children and their families living in deep poverty. For example, a family of four with an income of no more than $905 a month. The governor's supplemental budget funds an annual cost of living adjustment for the Minnesota Family Investment Program. ECOLA will put in motion an automatic increase that will continue to incrementally improve the well-being of children in deep poverty instead of waiting 35 years to increase it again. Thank you very much, and let's start to look at some of these proposals. The first is the repayment of the MAT and county IMD overpayments from 2019. We discussed this at your committee a couple of days ago. This would be an investment of $37.2 million. The DCT, Direct Care and Treatment, operating adjustment. As you know, we struggled with this issue all through last year and all of last year's sessions, and we still have an outstanding operating adjustment need of $49.9 million in the 22-23 biennium and $57.3 in 24 and 25. This just provides for an ongoing operating increase to cover the full cost of patients and clients in our state-operated treatment facilities, which we are very proud are COVID-free today in terms of all of the patients, clients, and individuals we serve across the state of Minnesota. The proposal has been adjusted some to reflect the timing of some of our hiring and is a little less than you saw it last. And now I'll turn it over to Acting Assistant Commissioner Lisa Bailey for Children and Family Services.
Let me just see if members have any questions on the overpayments or the DCT operating adjustments for Commissioner Harpstead. If you have a question, please raise your hand. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions from members. Okay, Assistant Commissioner Bailey, welcome to back to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee members. I'm Lisa Bailey. I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. Pandemic waivers and modifications that were put in place over the course of the pandemic response allowed us to provide safer and faster support for those who are most in need during the pandemic. As we transition out of the pandemic response, DHS proposes to concentrate our cash assistance recertifications in the summer and fall, deferring federal SNAP recertifications later into the year for which the state has more leeway. We also propose flexibility to potentially shift some recertification dates for households in order to help create an even workload for county and tribal human service agencies from month to month. Throughout the recertification process, households will be notified of which changes in circumstances they must report and whether they must begin monthly reporting. We also propose to allow counties and tribes to waive the need for an interview of recertification for general assistance, housing support, and Minnesota supplemental assistance if the information and documentation that has already been submitted is complete and aligns with the information we know. And in order to ensure households have that key information they need, we would increase the number of notices provided and mailing out up to 4 special notices regarding the changes at the end of the state peacetime emergency. We'd also create some temporary notices and special forms. In order to implement this plan, we would hire 3 temporary FTEs to coordinate planning across the programs, coordinate communications, and develop training for county and tribal eligibility workers. We're also proposing to introduce efficiencies and process allowed under the existing law to streamline that frontline work wherever possible. Next slide, please. This proposal includes investments from the General Fund and Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Fund, TANF Fund, in order to provide an annual cost of living increase in cash assistance provided through the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or MFIP, for families living in deep poverty, which, as you know, is deep poverty at or below the poverty level, which is for a family of three, is $1,810 a month. The poverty line is $1,810 a month. Deep poverty is no more than $905 a month. The MFIP cash assistance benefit now is well below that deep poverty line at $632 for a family of three. That's little more than half of what is needed for a 2-bedroom apartment at fair market rents that have been identified by HUD for the Twin Cities Metro. The families most likely to rely on assistance for extended period of time are families in which the parents are unable to sustain consistent work because of mental illness or other issues. Providing assistance closer to the cost of housing and basic needs would help those families stabilize more quickly and move out of the crisis that drove them to the MFIP program in the first place. As a side note, the federal income supports such as Social Security and SSIS all make annual cost of living adjustments. Next slide, please. We're also interested in looking at some areas of maintaining family connections in foster care, racial and ethnic disparities, and the disproportionality which have persisted in Minnesota's child welfare system for decades are seen at every decision point, every major decision point that's made in the child welfare system. This proposal targets family preservation, reunification, and permanency by first offering reform of background study requirements, trying to streamline requirements so that the same requirements apply for foster care as apply for adoption. The current system disproportionately impacts Native American communities, communities of color, whose children are overrepresented in foster care placement by making it harder for supportive parents to become foster parents. This proposal also strengthens legal requirements for removal of a child from the home by requiring additional court review of actual agency efforts, including an assessment of a child's safety and alternative family or kin-based arrangements. The proposal also clarifies agency requirements for locating, engaging with, and considering relatives for placement when children are entering foster care, and would clarify that under the statute, existing statute, placement decisions must be made on the child's short and long-term needs. There would also be some new requirements regarding explicit reports to the court about the court's efforts to place a child, or rather about the agency's efforts to place the child with family. And it removes the requirement that a relative must have an approved adoption home study in place. They're seeking to file a motion for adoptive study when they believe the agency has been unreasonable in not making that placement with them. And finally, it improves foster care licensing oversight by enabling, providing additional staffing to enable the licensing division to meet the increased workload, ensuring licensing activities across the state contribute to the reduction in racial disparities that's been well documented in our child welfare system. Next slide, please. The Federal Family First Prevention Services Act imposes significant new requirements in order for the state to continue to receive Title IV-E reimbursements. The department is using available federal funds to offset a portion of the cost of those requirements in fiscal year 22 and 23, and is adding three additional licensing staff in fiscal year 24 and 25 to assist in the licensing services that must be modified to comply with the federal law. This proposal continues the implementation of the FFPSA in Minnesota by providing the state resources necessary to get us to that compliance. It's absolutely essential that the implementation needs must be addressed during the 2021 session in order to meet that October 1st, 21 federal deadline for conformity. And that will allow us to ensure that Minnesota's counties and tribes can draw down the federal 4E fundings. The state would ensure that the child residential facilities meet the new federal standards by having DHS review and approve new certifications for licensed service providers. Legislation that was enacted in 2019 and 2020 did provide us the resources and statutory changes we needed to begin developing that state infrastructure. This proposal continues to prepare the state for implementation so that we reduce the risk of disruption to families. The proposal provides 11 additional staff for child safety and permanency, background studies, and licensing divisions, again, to ensure that we become compliant with federal law. With that, I can stand for questions and turn it over to my colleague, Gertrude Mutembo-Mutasa.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. We have some questions from members. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Ms. Bailey. I'm gonna revert back to your slide delving into the MFIP COLA. I'm just curious about, you know, has the agency given any thought in terms of how this calculation would be completed? you know, I certainly understand cost of living adjustments. The CPI is sometimes more volatile than other inflationary indexes. So wondering if you've considered other inflationary type indices. And then also, in the event that we have a budget deficit because this has been codified, would it take priority over other programs? And since are you calculating it upon the base of what year, or is it compounded based upon every year you're taking a new cost of living based upon the prior year's base rate?
Assistant Commissioner Bailey.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I'm going to defer to Deborah Schlick, who is our policy expert in that area, and I know she's present.
Thank you. Ms. Schlick, please introduce yourself and then proceed to answer.
Representative Schultz, I'm Deborah Schlick. I work in the Minnesota Department of Human Services in the Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division. Representative Schultz and Representative Albright, we are using the Consumer Price Index, proposing that because that is what is used in the SNAP program. Representative Albright is right. In some years, in SNAP, it has resulted in a slight decrease instead of a slight increase. But this would align MFIP with the SNAP program. We do have a waiver that allows us to combine the SNAP and cash benefits as a one calculated benefit, even though the SNAP portion can still only be spent on food. And the timing in October is to line up when we have to do the cost of living adjustment in the SNAP program each year. And, oh, I'm sorry, there was another question. It would be each year we would look at whether the cost, the consumer price index indicates that there has been an increase from the previous year. And so that would be looked at against the benefits that have been set for the last 12 months.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schlick, in the language that I would anticipate that we'll be seeing in the days ahead, is it mandatory, obligatory language that you're assuming, or is it more permissive for the legislature to take a look at what that CPI might do to the base rate, or is it an obligation upon the state to increase it regardless of circumstances prevailing at the time?
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Albright, the language would say that the state will put in place each year a cost of living adjustment. If the legislature didn't want that to happen in a year, then the legislature would take an action to, you know, change that law.
Representative Albright.
One final question, Madam Chair, and either for Ms. Bailey or Ms. Schlick, but under the Family First Prevention Services Act, I see that you're adding a good number of FTEs to comport with the federal Families First Prevention Services Act. What is the situation with those employees of the state after we have completed the implementation of those requirements?
Assistant Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. It's our understanding that those will be ongoing. These will be ongoing positions. We have the current positions have been working on implementing and getting everything in place for the beginnings of the act in October. But these would be ongoing positions, if that's your question.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Ms. Bailey, your slide implies that the 14 FTEs are necessary in order to ramp up for compliance rather than an ongoing need. Could you speak to whether it is a ramp up or and so that the folks are really trying to take care of the surge in coding and other applications and the compliance measures necessary versus ongoing. If this is one-time money that's coming from the federal government, why is it necessary then to also increase the number of FTEs in an agency just after we have completed that implementation?
Assistant Commissioner?
Senator, Commissioner, I'm looking at the Commissioner. I'm sorry, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright. The Family First Prevention Services Act did provide some federal funds that we are able to access now, and we have, and the legislature has provided some resources in the past to do this, as you call it, the ramp up. And that is something that is ongoing now. We have identified additional needs, such as the licensing positions that are going to be needed to get the facilities certified, and that certification process is in the works right now, and that would be able to be started if the legislature approves it over the summer into the fall. And so that's something that will be ongoing. We absolutely believe that. We do also believe that the additional requirements of the Family First Prevention Act are going to make it significantly more complex to administer than the current 4E requirements. And so while we've been working very hard to get it ramped up, we now know that there will be ongoing significant additional work that needs to be done in order to have the both the prevention services side and the qualified residential treatment programs licensed, and that they are continuing to be in a position so that the counties and tribes can draw down those 4E funds.
Okay, Representative Albright, we're going to move on and we'll come back to this, Representative Albright, if we have time at the end.
And I'm sure. I just want one quick question. Thank you for Ms. Bailey. Then, is that federal fund appropriation ongoing, or is there a sunset provision on that federal appropriation?
Commissioner Bailey.
Chair Schultz and Representative Albright, that was a one-time appropriation of, I believe it's $7.9 million.
Thank you. Representative Sandahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Bailey. I understand why the MFIB and SNAP programs may have been seeing an increase in applications during the last year. But listening to and reading your presentation, it makes me wonder if we're making any progress. The state is doing the best we can, I think, to help families who are having a tough time. But I wonder, over the last 15 or 20 years, are we making progress? Is the percentage of families who qualify for these services increasing, or is it decreasing? Are we maintaining the status quo? The number of people in deep poverty, of course, is terribly troubling. And I just wonder if we're making progress.
Commissioner Bailey?
Chair Schultz, Representative, I'm going to ask Deborah Schlick to speak to some of that historical information. And of course, we'd be happy to come back and talk more broadly about the state of the state of the world of cash assistance. And Ms. Schlick, you could address that.
Sure. Ms. Schlick?
Representative Schultz and Representative Sandahl. Our caseload before COVID pandemic, the caseload numbers had been getting to historic lows. Our caseloads react to the economy and to the labor market. We know from data that the most common reason someone applies for cash assistance in the MFIP program is that they've just lost or left a job. And those jobs are concentrated in four industries. They're concentrated in hotel, restaurant, retail, healthcare, and temporary agencies. So once you know those industry patterns, I bet we're not surprised that that as those industries went through crisis, that a lot of workers showed up our way. Those industries are least likely to have their workers collecting unemployment insurance benefits. So we're an alternative for low-wage workers to that. So as an economy improves, our caseloads increase. And I think the other piece in your question is there are always new families. So 78% of the families who do enroll in cash assistance are off in less than 2 years. Even if they come back and then come back, you know, that the total time they've used assistance is less than 2 years. Only 9% of the families we serve stay on for 3 years or more. So we're turning over the families we serve pretty frequently. They come to us in a crisis, the crisis is resolved, and then they're off assistance.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Ms. Schlick. I appreciate your responses. Thanks.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I that's what Ms. Schlick just said is something that I actually wanted to mention. I just wanted to make a brief comment, and that is that I'm very appreciative that DHS has gone in this direction with the COLA. Because first of all, I think that's an incredibly important point that Ms. Schlick made. These are not the same families. We're not talking about a family getting increases year over year. We're talking about the program when families come into it, offering something that hopefully actually lifts them out of deep poverty and lets them get back on their feet. So if we have a program that pays so little that it almost doesn't help, you know, that I think that's just really unconscionable. And we all know that it took about 30 years to actually give an increase in the dollar amount in this program. I just would hate to think that that could happen again. And finally, when we talk about MFIP, we just always have to remember, these are our children who we're talking about for the most part. You know, these are Minnesota's kids who are living in deep poverty. And, you know, I just would love to have our program get to the point where when somebody gets to that point of desperation, that they're willing to go through all of this paperwork and, you know, which hopefully we're starting to fix some of that problem. But when they come and actually jump over all these hurdles, that it actually helps them and actually gives them, relieves them of a little bit of the stress of immediate day-to-day survival so that they can get back on their feet. And I just really appreciate that the department is looking at that closely. And I just hope we can do this because I just think it's critical for our kids. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And just as a reminder to the public, I believe we increased it by $100. So it went from $532 to $632, and that was in 2019. And again, there's also a limit to how long they can receive these benefits, but we truly cannot deny that there's inflation. So I also second the support of doing this COLA adjustment. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Bailey. I had two questions. First, early on in your remarks, you mentioned about the recertification and some will be in the summer and some will be in the fall. Most likely the SNAP will go into the fall. Could you, somehow I thought I heard that we were gonna continue to allow waivers for tribes and counties. Did I misunderstand that?
Commissioner Bailey?
Thank you, Representative, or Chair and Representative Robbins. The request is for a waiver for the need for an in-person interview. And that would be for general assistance, housing support, and Minnesota supplemental assistance. And that would only be if the information and documentation that has been provided is complete and aligns with information already known to the system. So this is for recertifications and not for the initial interviews.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. And I'm assuming that's tied to some of the bills we've already heard. How long would that waiver extension be, or would it be permanent?
Commissioner Bailey.
It would not be permanent. I'm going to, I might ask Ms. Schlick if she could just clarify how long we're anticipating that, but it would certainly be tied. Well, I'll allow her to speak to that.
Ms. Schlick.
Representative Schultz and Representative Robbins, Assistant Commissioner Bailey is right. It is not a permanent waiver. It is what we're proposing to do is get started on the recertification process before, we hope before the end of the peacetime emergency. We're beginning the work now. We have to catch up on a year's worth of cash assistance recertifications in a 6-month period. So in order to make that possible for counties, one of the ways we're streamlining is to say just through the end of the year, if you've gotten all the information you need and that information is all verified, it is not necessary to do an interview. counties have told us that's a difference of about a half hour instead of an hour per recertification.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I want to switch gears for a moment and talk quickly about the Family First process. My understanding is that Minnesota is actually quite behind in getting our plan due in. I know technically it's not due until October, but my understanding is that many other states got theirs in July of 2019, and we're taking advantage of a federal 50% match. And now with COVID, that match has been increased to 100% for the current year. And so Minnesota has left a lot of money on the table by not getting our plan in. And so I just wondered if you could speak to, with all that, what federal money we have forgone by not getting it done, and why we have not been able to get it done to take advantage of that. Thank you.
Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, Representative Robbins. The Family First Act allowed states to decide when they wanted to opt in and opt and begin the process. And the end date is, as we've talked about, this October 1st date. For the prevention services side of the act, not the child, not the residential facility side, but for prevention services, that's an optional date. So you're correct that we as a state, prior to the pandemic, we made a decision to wait to implement and actually start the whole process until that October 1st date. And that even that is an optional date. There's a significant amount of work that has to go into preparing the facilities, the prevention services themselves to be set up, to be, they need to be accredited at the national level. They need to go through evidence-based processes. And we're in that process right now of ensuring what those processes are going to be in our state's plan. And you're correct that we have not submitted our plan yet. We're planning to do that this summer. Many other states are similarly waiting and waiting to get all of their facilities and processes in place before submitting the plan itself. And we've learned through we've been working very closely with other states nationally and state and federal cohorts on what the best way is to implement this. And we've learned that states that did it too early regretted that and were not actually in the best position to draw down those funds. And keep in mind that for the 50% reimbursement, there needs to be a state investment to pay for those prevention services up front, and then it's reimbursed. So you're correct. We are still in the process of doing this. We're trying to do it in a way that takes advantage of the resources that we have and identifies what we still need to do. We do have some prevention services that are already identified and others that we need to work harder to get them to a position where they're actually evidence-based practices. But that's something that's taking a significant amount of time and effort. So it's certainly something we're extremely aware of. We don't believe that we've left money on the table at this point, as some have said. Again, as I said, the prevention services themselves need to be in place and ready to be administered by local organizations before we can draw down those funds. And we're just not at that place yet.
And to follow up, and I'll come back to you, Representative Robbins, but related to that, if we would have implemented it early and we didn't have a provider certified, we wouldn't have been able to get reimbursed by the federal government. Is that correct, Commissioner Bailey?
That is correct, Chair Schultz.
Okay, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I may follow up with you offline. It's a much broader conversation. I know we want to focus on the governor's budget, but this is of concern to me. And I think in general, we always want to take advantage of federal matching money when it's available. So perhaps we can have another discussion. But thank you for that answer. It helps.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. And I have another question. So I'm concerned that we won't have a sufficient number of QRTP certified. Is there a way, or is there any money for grants to the providers to help them with the certification? So our local public health agencies have places for referrals? Commissioner Bailey?
Madam Chair, we have identified some of those Family First Transition Act funds, that one-time federal funding allocation to be used for those, not for the certification process, but for the federal accreditation process, which is another process they need to go through. We think about 34 facilities in Minnesota are right now, have already gone through that accreditation process. They will need to be certified this summer, but they will be first in line to be certified. We're working very hard to make sure as many are in place and ready to go on October 1st as possible.
Thank you, Commissioner Bailey. I'm not seeing any more questions on this section, so members will move on. The next section is community supports, and we have Assistant Commissioner Matemba Matusa. Welcome back to the committee. Commissioner, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Gertrude Matemba Matusa. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Community Supports at DHS. My first item is related to PCA rate increases. In January of 2021, the SEIU negotiated and entered into a contract with the state. This proposal funds obligations to SEIU-represented union workers as specified in that contract. The contract includes wage increases, paid time off, and also provides training grants in both fiscal year 22-23 and 24-25. It's important to note that these increases impact all PCA rates, not just union employees. Some changes that we're proposing to the original proposal, a major change would be the proposal would now include cost reporting for PCA and Community First Support Services agencies. Now, cost reporting is important because it will support data-driven improvements to future rate setting. Cost reporting provides a consistent basis for the commissioner to determine whether the rate paid to providers covers the costs to provide the PCA service. As some of you may know, this has been a point of contention for so many years between the state and PCA providers. Next slide, please. The right-sizing exercise related to the behavioral health grants reduces or eliminates certain behavioral health grants. The original reduction for this proposal was $6.3 million for the 22-23 biennium and $2 million for the 24-25 biennium. With this proposed change, the reductions will now total $1.8 million in 22 and 23 and neutral in 24-25, so a significant reduction in savings there. Of the items on the original list earmarked to be reduced or cut, funding for adult mental health initiative grants, commonly known as AMHI, is fully restored. Mental health first aid training and SUD recovery peer grants are refinanced with federal funds and maintained at their current level for grantees. The only item that remains of the original list is the one-time transfer of $1 million from the lottery fund to the general fund as part of that realignment exercise. Next slide, please. As it relates to realigning disability grants, the following changes were made from the previous proposal. The previous reduction was $8.9 million in both the 22-23 and 24-25 biennia. So that would have been a total of $18 million in savings. It has now been reduced to $5.7 million in 22 and 23 and $1.6 million in 24 and 25. Another significant reduction there. And we arrived at this by reducing the family support, by making sure that reductions to family support and sales grants are now one time only, as opposed to being ongoing or in both biennia. The funding for the innovation grants is now restored. And the savings that were proposed in the original proposal to state quality council grants are now being reinvested in regional quality council grants. And this is a budget neutral item. The reduction total still includes the full reduction of the day training and habilitation grants on an ongoing basis. And that totals to about $1.6 million for the biennium. Next slide, please. Now, regarding emergency shelter and HMIS, we know that homelessness is an ongoing crisis that continues to impact communities across the state. The previous budget proposal amount was $20.9 million in fiscal year 22-23, and then $21 million in 24-25. This proposal increases the investment to $21.3 million and 21.4 in 22-23 and 24-25, respectively. This new update to this proposal has a key component, which if you look at the previous proposal, we had two FTEs included. This change proposes to add two additional FTEs. And the reason for that is those would be added to the housing division to meet the higher than expected demand for housing stabilization services. And just as a reminder, the housing stabilization services was a Medicaid benefit that was launched in July of 2020. And the demand for this program has exceeded any of the projections that we had planned for. And those two FTEs will go towards that. That's all I have. I could now take questions.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, referring back to the right size behavioral health grant slide page, the first bullet item describes the reduction or elimination of certain behavioral health grants. I'm wondering if she could elaborate on with some specificity in terms of what those were or will, what ones are going to be reduced or eliminated.
Assistant Commissioner Mutemba Matusa.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. So the original list had the Adult Mental Health Initiative grants. It had the mental health first aid training grants, the SUD recovery peer grants. It had the transfer of the gambling proceeds, and it also as it on the list. So what we've done is, after receiving feedback from others, is to really restore the Adult Mental Health Initiative grants to where they were before that initial proposal. And then in order for us to keep the mental health first aid training and SUD recovery peer grants, the way we were able to keep that, to take that off the savings list was to refinance them using block grants that we already had within the Behavioral Health Division. So of that long list that we had previously, the only item that's left is a one-time transfer of $1 million from the gambling proceeds fund to the general fund. So basically, if you look at that original list, you're only going to really essentially have one item left on the in the savings column.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. Under emergency shelter, HIMS, and the community living grants, two questions. Your bullet points suggest an addition of two FTEs, but the large circle remarks on four. Why the difference?
Assistant Commissioner.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. The original proposal already included two FTEs. And then between the time that that original proposal was created and the update that we've just made, we realized that we needed an additional two FTEs. And to really clarify the magnitude of this need, currently we have over 1,000 individuals that are on the waiting list, waiting to receive housing stabilization services. And our partners in the healthcare administration within DHS are currently lending us some of their staff to be able to meet that need. And so we know, just based on the demand in our current projections, that the original two that we had proposed initially are not going to be able to cover the need, and so we're adding two more.
Okay, one more question, Representative Albright. Then we have Representative Fisher, Representative Knorr, Representative Rasmussen, and then Chair Liebling. Go ahead, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier on that same slide, fairly substantial year-over-year increases in the investment in these programs. Is that and is the increase that you're proposing here in response to the new budget, state budget forecast, or is it in response to monies that have been identified and you have identified as being potentially used for this from the federal relief acts?
Assistant Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, when you say year over year increase, I'm not clear on which particular numbers you are looking at.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Denote in 22-23, 21.3 million, and in 24-25, 21.4 million that is being appropriated for this effort.
Assistant Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative. So I'm not sure if it's going to be helpful to maybe go back to what we're going to use this funding for. So this is a package that includes not only shelter, but the HMIS system that helps us to track who needs housing services across the whole system. And so the original proposal from 20.9 to 20.9 in 22-23, and then 21 million were based on the actual needs in the system for grants or for shelter, as well as for HMIS. Now, the jump to 21.3 accounts for the FTE, the additional FTEs that we'll need during that time period. I don't know if that answers your question, Representative.
Yeah, Assistant Commissioner, Representative Albright, we can get into the weeds next week too, and we have the language in front of us. I'm going to move on to Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my questions are for Assistant Commissioner Mutaba Mutasa. Thank you for being here today, and thank you to the commissioner for being here today. My questions are back in the behavioral health area, and I just want to kind of reference a couple of things to make sure I'm understanding it properly on the behavioral health area. As I know that in the first presentation we had back in January, originally in this area it was looked at that there would be savings of about $14 million in behavioral health, and I remember at that time we were suffering a deficit projection, and that cuts were being looked for in the area. And I expressed concerns about that, saying we should look at reinvesting in here. So I'm happy to see that we are no longer looking at those savings, but looking at the savings are being reinvested. So one of the areas I was kind of wondering on is, I know that a big area that savings were being looked at originally was in the substance use disorder reform package. I know there's work going on that. I think that's the 1115 project. And I was wondering what is where we are on that right now and how we're looking at reinvesting some of those dollars that were being saved before that we're capturing to make the program stronger.
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Fisher. The reform package for 1115 SUD waiver has generated quite a bit of discussion between DHS and stakeholders. The most updated information I have is that we are now holding weekly meetings with key stakeholders such as MARCH to figure out how we can make this package meaningful to providers and the people who receive our services. And so there'll be more on that to come, hopefully within the next few weeks.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner. I will look forward to, I've been getting some updates on that. Appreciate the work. It sounds like both sides are engaged in very serious discussions on that to move things forward at, that will make the system much stronger than it is right now and allow the system to grow out. And looking forward to be kept appraised of the details so that we can build a better behavioral health system than we have now. I'm kind of excited with what I'm tentatively hearing and encourage you folks to keep up the good work on that along with the folks from MARCH and the other providers to continue moving those items forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Assistant Commissioner Matemba Mutasa, my question is in regards to slide 11, the increase for the PCA rates. I know I had asked about analysis to ensure that the increase reflects the market and to be able to withstand the changes that are happening. I don't know if this issue was addressed at the beginning. We know that the FMAP increased by 10% through the new package from the federal government is effective April 1. How will that all come together to make sure that we're able to comply with increases that are necessary to ensure that we pay the essential workers who are on the front line at the same time to be able to have analysis on what is the appropriate amount of increase to meet the needs at this point?
Assistant Commissioner Matemba Mutasa, maybe you can take the first piece of that.
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative North. So when we think about PCA rates, one of the things that we know is that when we negotiate every year, there are a set of assumptions that are not agreed to by both sides. And this sort of creates this really inefficient process where the state believes that the rate that we're paying is adequate to cover the cost to provide those services. And so over time, what we've realized is that we really need to create a methodology that's consistent and fair. Our ultimate goal is to make sure that our providers stay in the business. And if we're paying a rate that is below what it takes to cover the cost of providing those services, then we're going to end up with a system that has no providers. And so that doesn't serve anyone. And so by creating a cost reporting methodology, essentially you have real data from all the providers within the system being fed to DHS, and that data is analyzed to really arrive at this is exactly how much it costs. And that's going to be done on a regular basis. So that is how you get to this point where you have a starting point where everybody understands this is the data that we've received, this is how much it actually costs, and then DHS can set a rate based on actual data instead of, you know, who gets to negotiate, you know, better than the other party. And so that's the approach. And we believe that cost reporting is really going to be a fair and efficient way to ensure that our providers stay in business long term.
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, I think the other section that I asked is because of the FMAP increase by 10% effective April 1, 2021, which is just a few days away from the federal program, which really will impact PCAs and most of the essential workers in HCBS. So how will that impact this process of increasing the rate temporarily?
Commissioner Mutasa Mutumba or Bailey, Assistant Commissioner Bailey, either want to take that question?
Chair Schultz, Representative, could you please repeat the question? I'm sorry, I was looking away.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Bailey, the question is in regards to the increase from the federal American Rescue Plan for 10% for the home and community-based services, which is meant for helping those who are on the front lines. That is effective April 1, 2021. What is the plan for the state in regards to that account?
Madam Chair, this is Dave Greenman.
Hi.
We are currently assessing that the language in the federal law to determine how we can implement it. We're looking at this point to get some guidance from the feds in terms of exactly how to implement it. We certainly recognize the urgency that April 1st is coming up and want to make sure that we make whatever use we can of that provision. So we're hoping to have some information, and we'll certainly provide that to you as soon as we get it. At this point, we don't have it right now, though.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Representative Noor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greenman, I hope we can get that information sooner than later so that we can be able to utilize the information that you share with us. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Noor. Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the presentation today. Given our conversation earlier this week, just wanted to say that I was pleased to see that the adult mental health initiative grants have been fully restored. I just know from talking with constituents in the district I represent, mental health, behavioral health issues is just such a priority facing our communities across the state. And so I was glad to see the prioritization made there. The other comment just wanted to make briefly is, I know there's a big push to move a lot, you know, more dollars into housing more broadly. And that's been an issue that has been talked about in a lot of the committees that I'm fortunate to serve on. And I just think, you know, at some point it might make sense for us to just kind of pull up and have a broader conversation around, you know, what's going on with this new DHS budget proposal, you know, what other committees have kind of baked into their targets, including, you know, the housing committee, capital investment, et cetera. And I just want to make sure that you know, dollars that are going out for housing really are getting a good return on their investment. And we're not just kind of throwing a bunch of money out there to create new programs that are kind of unsustainable for us going forward. And so that'll just be a question I'll be working on. I just wanted to flag for the committee, but thank you for the presentation and appreciate the time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Chair Liebling.
Madam Chair, thank you very much and appreciate the presentation today. I want to raise a kind of a question and a little bit of concern about the one piece that's kind of left as a savings in the budget, which is that $1 million that's being taken from the gambling program. I'd like to understand a little bit better about that because for one thing, I guess I would say, and you know, I would fault myself for this in part, that we don't pay enough attention to gambling as an addiction issue. And but we do know that gambling is a factor, and I don't have the data, but it's a factor in a lot of family breakdown, probably suicide. And so this is really a serious addiction problem. I don't know if we even have good data about how widespread this is, but I'm a little bit concerned. We have to my knowledge, we have only a very small program in the state that addresses this. And I think what I'm hearing is that the budget takes money away from that. And I wonder if I could get a bit more explanation either here or offline about what that's doing and what the decision is around that. Thank you.
The Assistant Commissioner Mutemba Matusa or Mr. Greenman, can you help answer Chair Liebling's question?
I can kick us off. And so to the magnitude of the problem in our state, our latest data based on the research that we commissioned with Wilder indicates that about 56,000 Minnesotans are impacted by problem gambling. It's always important to distinguish between gambling and problem gambling. And then in addition to that, another data point is that maybe double that 56,000 are people who are indirectly impacted by problem gambling. The most important thing to remember about this transfer is that because we think, we believe that this is a serious problem in our state, the actual funding to the provider is remaining intact. Nothing is changing related to this. So we're continuing to invest at the same level as before. Now, the transfer was being made, was proposed to be made because of this realignment where we were trying to make up for the budget shortfall. Anything more than that, I guess maybe Dave, if you have additional information, but I wanted to provide that as sort of background on the issue and how we're viewing it in Minnesota at this point.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Greenman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I would add is that the reason we have a surplus in that account is there's been an upswing in e-poll tab sales in 2018 and 2019 that fueled additional revenue into the account that is currently not being used. So as the assistant commissioner said, we're We're not actually reducing services. We're just taking what's in the taking the surplus and moving that, transferring that to the general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Chair Liebling?
Yeah, okay. And thank you for that. And of course, absolutely, you're right, Assistant Commissioner, that I should distinguish carefully between gambling and problem gambling. Just like, of course, we have plenty of people who drink alcohol and are not problem drinkers. So absolutely, you're right. But I think we just don't talk enough about the impact of gambling. And I that's something that I intend to begin to remedy in the future, because we need to really think about that as part of what's going on when we talk about substance use a lot and SUD a lot, but to my knowledge, I'm usually not in the room, at least when this is being discussed. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Okay, we're going to move on to the next presentation. We have Assistant Commissioner Pollack here to talk about continuing care for older adults. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, good morning, Madam Chair.
Please proceed, Assistant Commissioner.
Great, thank you so much. I will be brief. I know it's been a long morning. We have one additional item for nursing facility reimbursement, and this is a relatively small impact, but it's an important one. This is a consumer protection issue, and it's actually not a new idea. This issue came up in the 2018 session. It came up in the 2019 session. It represented bipartisan legislation in the 2020 session, including legislation authored by the chair and Representative Lislegard, Representative Lewick, Representative Cleavorn, Representative Lippert. It received bipartisan support in the Senate in 2020. And unfortunately, I think because of the pandemic, we really just weren't able to get around to fixing this issue. And so in brief, this is essentially a billing problem that happens when a nursing facility resident is receiving therapy or perhaps in need of isolation space, which is more expensive due to an infectious disease like COVID. And during that time, we pay a higher rate based on their need. However, under current law, we only reassess them for the need for that service every 90 days. So if somebody stops needing the therapy or stops needing the isolation space at a period sooner than 90 days, we keep paying it. And that is very problematic. It's problematic for Medicaid and largely for private pay as well, which is a parallel system. They pay the same rates. So you may have already heard about this issue from constituents. It comes up a lot. I think it's the most frequently reported complaint about nursing home billing. And so we would be changing this to align the reimbursement with the assessed needs of the resident. This produces some savings. The governor's revised budget invests some of these savings in a couple different ways that are highlighted on this slide that we think are very high priorities for nursing facility care. First is hiring 6 forensic accountants for DHS. These are auditors who are trained to look for either fraud or improper billing. They are extremely effective at their work, the ones we have currently. This would be expanding that unit. And I would say that the experience of COVID and the numerous fund sources related to the COVID response have only made that work more complicated, and it is timely and needed for those forensic accountants. A second piece is a new federal requirement that was put on hold during COVID and we expect to come back. It has to do with the system that we use. I won't get into the details of the data management system. It relates to how case mix needs are identified. This is something that the providers also are interested in working with us on, and meeting those federal requirements would have a cost, a new cost. And then lastly, we are updating the nursing facility consumer satisfaction surveys. That's survey tools that were first authorized 15 years ago, but the appropriation has not been updated in that period of time. Obviously, doing survey work is much more complicated and expensive now than it was in the early part of the century. So just a couple of small items that I think are relatively non-controversial, and I'm happy to take questions on them.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Pollack. And this was some of these were from the Blue Ribbon Commission recommendations. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to be really clear about which part of this is from the Blue Ribbon Commission. That's a very long report. It's 200 plus pages long. If you are reading the item on nursing facility rates on page 164, this is only the fourth bullet. This is only one tiny piece of the Blue Ribbon Commission strategies related to nursing facility rates.
Okay, thank you. I'm not seeing any questions from members for Assistant Commissioner Pollack. So we will move on to the next section. We have Christy Grom here from DHS to talk about customized living, and there's no PowerPoint, so. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Grom. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. So I've been asked to give a brief overview of customized living services as they relate to primarily disability services, and then to walk through a couple of our customized living budget proposals that are in the governor's budget this cycle. So before diving into the budget proposals, I'll give some background. So customized living services are home and community-based services for people with disabilities who are on the brain injury and CADI, or Community Access for Disability Inclusion Waiver, as well as for older adults on the elderly waiver, the EW waiver. So to give you a picture of what customized living looks like in action, it might be helpful to maybe think about a person you know who may have lived in an assisted living facility. So customized living is essentially the service set that's offered in those settings. So it's a menu of individualized scheduled health services that a person gets when they live in these qualified settings. I think it's helpful to note that customized living is really a service that was developed to meet the health needs of older adults. So it continues to work well for older adults, but we found that it's not the best fit for most people with disabilities who are using the brain injury and the CADI waivers. So knowing that, how did we get to a place where people with disabilities using BI and CADI waivers are now using customized living services? So a little bit of history. Following the passage and the implementation of the corporate foster care moratorium in 2009, we saw lead agencies, providers, and sometimes families looking for creative ways to and different models to support people living in community settings. So there was this wave of service arrangements that were coming about post corporate foster care moratorium that ended up being inconsistent across the state, sometimes leading to an imbalance, essentially leading to disparities in accessing services, depending on what corner of the state a person may have lived in. In addition to the uniformity issues, we did see that the service arrangements in some cases were really testing the boundaries of what would be allowable under our federally funded home and community-based waiver services. Some of the compliance issues that we saw, we've addressed through administrative actions, working with lead agencies in the support planning process, and then others were addressed through what we call the tiered standards for BI and CADI customized living. So in combination with establishing tiered standards for customized living for BI and CADI, we also engaged with the community to develop a new waiver service that better fit the needs of people with disabilities called integrated community support. Just for a little bit of background, we talk about the term tiered standards. It's a buzzword you hear us use, but really what that means is that the service has a higher standard for new people that are authorized to receive the service. So the new tiered standards for customized living will meet the home and community-based services rule regulations and better support integrated service models for people with disabilities. Effectively, this means that as of January of this year, people on the BI and CADI waivers who are 55 and under who want to live in those customized living-like settings, in other words, essentially an apartment that's provider-controlled and maybe has a front desk, will instead access the new waiver service called Integrated Community Support. Won't go into all of the details of what that service is, but I think it's important to note that this is a 245D licensed service, which is different than standards around customized living. So it includes important protections related to service termination and staff qualifications and trainings that are uniquely tailored for people who are using services on those disability waivers. So moving a little bit closer to the governor's proposals, talking a little bit about customized living rates and what those look like. So most services that are available under disability waivers have cost-based rates, prospective cost-based rates that are set by our disability waiver system. So we've talked a lot about those throughout the years here in committee, but essentially we look at cost components, which could be administrative costs, staff wages and benefits, sometimes customization costs, depending on the person. And we use a calculation to build a rate that reasonably covers those costs. Customized living rates, on the other hand, are a little bit different. They are instead set with lead agencies, usually in communication with providers, where there's a number of hours or units that are entered into what we call a customized living service rate tool. And over the past several years, we've seen increases in these hourly entries. So for example, in the mental health category, between fiscal years 2017 and 2019, we saw a 118% increase, so approximately $40 million increased spending for BI and CADI and customized living. So the increase in units combined with increased utilization as well have led to that overall increase in spending that we've seen throughout the past few forecast cycles. So that brings me to our proposals in the governor's budget this year. So we have two that are related to customized living for people who are on the brain injury and CADI waivers. The first of which is related to program integrity. It was a Blue Ribbon Commission proposal. This is a proposal that ensures the integrity of the support hours entered into the customized living rate tool that I mentioned a bit ago. So it simply places a 24-hour limit of daily support that can be entered into the rate tool for BI and CADI waiver recipients. So we'd program a limit into the system, and if providers or lead agencies entered more units than 24 hours, then they would get an error message and they wouldn't be able to enter more than 24 hours. So we think this is a pretty common sense program integrity reform. Not many providers were entering more than 24 hours, but we did see in fiscal year 2019, about 2% of people on BI and CADI had hours in excess of 24 hours. So this is just to rectify that and make sure that we've got appropriate program integrity measures in place. Then the next proposal that I will touch on is titled Acuity-Based Customized Living and Closing the Corporate Foster Care Loophole. So this is a budget proposal that has two main fiscal impacts, the first of which aligns customized living services with a person's assessed support needs, and the second part of it establishes a moratorium for customized living settings that serve people with four or fewer people. The modifications in this proposal are just ensuring that authorized services are consistent with people's support needs and that we have appropriate licensure of these four-person settings that really do look a lot like corporate foster care and not the intended customized living settings. So the first part of the proposal, which I mentioned, limits the amount of supports available to people receiving customized living services under CADI and BI based on their assessed needs. So the way we developed this provision was we looked at average inputs for customized living rate calculations and placed some parameters around the rate tool and the inputs that appeared to be in some cases a little bit misaligned with the assessed support needs. So for example, we are under this proposal not allowing more than 2 hours of mental health supports per day for people without an actual assessed behavioral health need. And then we're not allowing more than 4 hours of support per day for activities of daily living, which would include things like dressing or eating, for people who have low activity of daily living needs, that particular case mix. And then finally, we're saying that no more than 6 hours of ADL support could be provided to people with people in the medium need case mix. So there will continue to be exceptions. So if people fall outside of these, if they have support needs that fall outside of these parameters, counties will be able to work with the department and request an exception in those cases. And then the next part of this proposal is limiting the four-person customized living setting. So this essentially limits developments that serve four or fewer people on CADI and BI who live in a single family home. So under this proposal, these settings won't be able to be enrolled to provide customized living services. What we found is that these types of customized living settings often meet the definition of a corporate foster care setting, and we believe they should be licensed as such, just to ensure that they're being compliant with the corporate foster care moratorium and that we're not creating a separate pathway for these settings that was unintended by the legislature. So through the process of limiting growth in these settings, we may also determine that there might be some pre-existing sites that need to be licensed as a residential program. So in order to transition these sites under this proposal, we would be asking for authority to establish an exception to the licensing moratorium for those settings to come into compliance. Madam Chair, I hope that's a helpful overview for you and members. I'm happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grom, for that overview. Are there any questions for members, either to Assistant Commissioner Pollack or Ms. Grom? I am not seeing any questions for members on these two sections. So I want to thank all of the Commissioner Harpstead and the Assistant Commissioners and Ms. Grom for being with us today to answer our questions and give us this overview. I don't know if Commissioner Harpstead is still on and if she wants to make any closing comments. Go ahead, Commissioner Harpstead.
Not particularly, Chair Schultz, but just thank you so much for your time this morning and your very good questions working to understand the proposals that we've put forward.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all. So members, just a reminder, our next meeting will likely be Wednesday at 8:30. And so we will go from 8:30 until 10 with a 30-minute break and then reconvene at 10:30 and go till noon to hear bills and more budget information. I don't, Representative Chair Fisher, did you have a comment? Your hand was up. No. Okay. So with that, members, thank you again. Enjoy your weekend, and I will see everybody likely on Wednesday morning. And with that, we are adjourned.